produced at the studios of KBOO Radio in Portland, Oregon. This is Free Culture Radio. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. On this edition of Free Culture Radio, trying to make sense of it all. We're now living in some of the most interesting times I've ever experienced. To try and make sense of it all, I spoke recently with a good friend.
I am San Ho Tri. I'm a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies. And for the past 27 years now, I've been directing the drug policy project there, looking at both the domestic and international war on drugs.
So it's been so long since I've been in D.C. What's new?
You know, these past few weeks, it's kind of felt like the wildfires in L.A., except there's no physical damage. It's like a neutron bomb has hit D.C., right? The buildings are intact, but the population has been decimated. And that's what's been happening to people I know. My ex got the USAID layoff, the 3 weeks ago he got that. Cease and desist, stop work. Others, NIH and other places have all been either laid off or are awaiting their terminations. This has been a real blitzkrieg, and we knew this was coming on the part of Elon and Trump. It was always part of their shock and awe plan to, you know, for the past 4 years, they've been plotting on different types of revenge and what they're going to do when they come to power. And they loaded all those ideas into a blunderbuss and just pulled the trigger. And so, yeah, people are supposed to feel demoralized and disoriented and discombobulated. That was their intent. But it's also important to realize they're being manipulated to feel that way. They're not as competent as they sound. And they don't sound all that competent the more we look at what they're doing. And so, yes, the return volley will be happening. It'll be happening in waves. It'll be happening over the next few months and the next 4 years. So I hold out some hope in that Trump will be Trump, that he will turn the next 205 weeks into infrastructure week every week. Those who remember his first term, right? He tried to do infrastructure week over and over and over and over throughout his presidency. Couldn't do it to save his life because his own mouth got in the way. He would tweet something insane. He would cause some other scandal. It would suck all of the oxygen out of the room. And all the work his staffers put into whatever, advancing whatever project, went up in flames every single week. So, and this time it'll be worse in the sense that in his first term, there he at least had some, you know, more traditional Republicans in his administration that would tell him, sir, that's against the law. At this point, no one's willing to tell him any such thing. And every idea is a brilliant idea, boss. And so he's making a lot more mistakes and making them a lot faster. But it's also much more dangerous because there are no checks or balances on his behavior now.
Let's take a look at some of those dangers, shall we? On domestic side, I mean, the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, that law mandated that insurance that's purchased through those health exchanges as well as offered through Medicaid programs would cover treatment for substance use disorder. Now, Republicans have targeted the ACA from the jump. They haven't yet succeeded in getting rid of it. I wonder sometimes if the ACA would stand a better chance if people stopped calling it Obamacare and started calling it Trump Care. We've got RFK Jr. I mean, methadone and buprenorphine are the gold standard for opioid substitution treatment. RFK Jr. is a firm believer in 12-step programs as the answer. Doesn't, you know, may have paid lip service in his confirmation hearing to the idea of allowing substitution treatment, but people pay lip service to all kinds of things in their confirmation hearings. Before the election, he floated the idea of setting up a network of work farms that would be funded by marijuana revenue. Isolated, no internet, no communication with the outside world. People stay there until they're healthy. There's supposed to be a question here, and I'm still processing how we got there. I'll get to one eventually. I mean, I thought those work farms were actually going to be a major part of the current administration's plan for migrants. You know, work farms in the states that aren't on the border and then concentration camps in the border states. And it actually leads me to immigration. And, you know, I've got you here and you are one of the experts I know on some of these issues internationally with Colombia, with Mexico. There's a little tension on that border now. What is going on?
So yeah, there's so much going on. First, on the RFK business, right? I think it's important to remember what this administration is, especially people like Steve Bannon, had been vowing and plotting for the past 8, 9 years now. It goes back to his speech at CPAC in February 2017, way back then. He said his goal was one of his goals was the deconstruction of the administrative state. Now, when he said this in 2017, everyone scratched their heads and said, "This is crazy. This man is, he's delusional." This has been what he's been plotting at for the past 8 years, and he is in that position now to execute on it. And so, when you look at each of these nominees for the heads of these various departments and agencies, almost to a person, they have been the absolute worst candidates imaginable. Right. It's Abraham Lincoln had a team of rivals. Donald Trump has a team of trolls who have spent, the better part of a decade trying to destroy and undermine the very agencies they are now selected to lead. And that is how you deconstruct the administrative state. That's not to say the entire administration's on that wavelength, but they are headed in a similar direction. So you have people like Elon Musk, who hates Steve Bannon, and they hate each other, but Elon just wants to dismantle government so he can cut $2 trillion and get himself a huge tax break for oligarchs. And he's willing to do whatever it takes to do that, as well as plunder all the data for himself. You've got people like Stephen Miller, who may not be on board for all of this, but he's a fascist and a racist. And so as long as these objectives, take him down that path, they're all on a similar trajectory right now, which is the deconstruction of the administrative state. These people not only want to roll back Obamacare, they didn't like the Great Society under LBJ. They didn't like the New Deal under FDR. They didn't even like the Square Deal a century ago. They're literally trying to roll this back to the 1890s, to the Gilded Age of the robber barons, where, Upton Sinclair's The Jungle, there was no food inspection, there was no income tax. There was a formal empire where we colonized and called ourselves an empire. We colonized the Philippines for 50 years. That's the era they want to roll this clock back to. So people have said, oh, he just wants to roll it back to the pre-civil rights era, which is bad enough. No, he wants to go all the way back. And I think they want to privatize as much of the government as they possibly can, get rid of income taxes, have tariffs, which is a notoriously, hard to predict income stream, so to speak, to balance the budget rather than income tax, which is a fairly predictable stream of income. This is calamity. We're headed for this absolute train wreck of accountability here. But on the question of foreign policy, you asked about Mexico, for instance. This is one of my greatest fears right now, is that Trump and the Republicans have been talking about attacking Mexico for more than a year now. They passed resolutions about taking military action to go after the cartels to wipe out fentanyl, quote unquote. And this kind of banter, and Pete Hegseth, the Secretary of Defense, is a big proponent of this, but they don't know what they're talking about. They have not thought this through, other than a Fox News rah-rah talking point. Because if you talk to anyone with any experience in any kind of military planning, you would ask, they would ask, what would victory look like against cartels? Is there a strategic hilltop to seize? Is there a flag to capture? Is there a river to cross? A capital to occupy? It's really easy to wade into a quagmire. It's very hard to get out of one. Mike Tyson, the boxer, used to have a saying, everyone's got a strategy until they get punched in the face. Right. And what these people don't understand is that your adversary also gets a vote. They get a counter move. And they just think, well, I'll just punch them here and here and that'll be it. No. What happens when the cartels do what they've been doing for the past 20 years, which people who follow drug policy know, but most Americans are oblivious to? What happens when they start hanging the corpses of U.S. executives and plant managers and retirees from bridges along the border? Right, which is what they've done in Mexico for a long time to Mexicans. What happens when they enter a, I was in Acapulco in 2012 when the cartels took over, and one of the first things they did was they went into a very popular discotheque, and they brought in a sack. It was full of human heads, and they just rolled the heads under the floor and said, what are you going to do about it? We're in power now. So what happens if the cartels decide, if Trump actually manages to hurt the cartels, which is impossible, because they're trying to bomb fentanyl labs, which is the size of a room in the size of Mexico that can be easily moved. And they think they're going to destroy this somehow. But what happens if they decide, okay, you want to play tough, we'll play tough. And they start planting IEDs along the highways leading up to the border. So imagine the supply lines to auto parts to Detroit. Imagine our fruits and vegetables that we depend on so much for in the wintertime, not to mention your avocados and limes for Super Bowl and all this other stuff. No trucker is going to risk their livelihoods and their lives and their trucks on transiting stuff to the U.S. if that's the price they could have to pay. This is a common tactic used in Mexico, but also in Colombia for decades. The FARC guerrillas used to have these what's called armed strikes, a paro armado. They would say there will, for the next 2 weeks or 3 weeks or 4 months, there will be no traffic in this region. And if we catch your vehicle on the road, we will burn it without question. And we may actually kill you as well. So that's what they can do if they wanted to play hardball with the U.S. Imagine the 444 days of Jimmy Carter's nightmare with the Iran hostage crisis, right? And think of how many retirees and tourists, U.S. citizens, are in Mexico. Imagine if the cartel started taking them hostage and sending back fingers and thumbs bit by bit. And this would drag on for year after year after year. How are you going to deal with that? These people have not thought this through at all. And I think they're running headlong into a quagmire.
This is my conversation with Sanho Tri, a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies, where he's director of IPS's Drug Policy Project. You're listening to Free Culture Radio. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. I wish Breaking Bad were still on. Oh, I never have watched that. I really have to one of these days. But the idea of someone just applying science and making very high potency drugs using the chemicals they can find domestically. I wonder, if you could speculate for a moment, if they do manage to make it a little more difficult to move bulk product over the international borders, would there be anything, do you think, to stop the cartels from setting up labs up here in the U.S.?
Actually, no, because they've already got some labs in the U.S., but it's important to remember that a lot of the precursor chemicals going into Mexico to make the fentanyl is transiting through the United States. Reuters did a very good deep dive into this, I think, back in the fall, where they looked at how do these precursors get from small businesses in China into Mexico. And they found a lot of it came through U.S. Shipments purchased on, the various platforms, e-commerce platforms. And you know how you buy stuff off of Amazon or eBay from China? If it's under, I think, $800 or under a certain amount, it's considered de minimis. That means they don't have to go through customs to get taxed and all this stuff, tariffed, right? And so they go through and they put these in big containers and they put them on airplanes and they ship them through. And so then they go through the postal system in the U.S. And once they arrive in the U.S., then they're smuggled south into Mexico. So all they have to do is keep the chemicals in the U.S. if they wanted to do that. But you can find a lab, a room anywhere to do this stuff. And so that's the problem with trying to do source control and interdicting precursors. But I also think the other thing that creates kind of a perfect storm of disaster for us and danger is the rise of AI. And so AI has already been used for drug discovery, for instance, for finding compounds that work against, multi-drug resistant bacteria, which is a good thing, right? We're running out of antibiotics that, some of these drug resistant strains are very, very dangerous. And so it's good that they're discovering some of these new chemicals because AI can sift through and remember tens of thousands of journal articles and figure out which compounds, hey, there's a common thread here. But similarly, and I'm not a chemist, but I do know that there are multiple pathways to the same chemical destination. And you could put AI onto that problem. And I'm sure the cartels are already doing this. Any chemist knows how to, you know, what are the workarounds? If this particular compound is banned, what could I use to substitute and perhaps get to the same destination or get to a similar neighborhood? So we already have dozens of analogs of fentanyl, some of which are far deadlier than the stuff that's on the street now, like carfentanil. That could, you know, popularize analogs that are currently not popular because they're risky and dangerous, but it'll be easier to make, perhaps. Or it could lead to a whole new era of synthetic drug discovery in general, not even analogs of fentanyl, but whole new classes of drugs we haven't even thought of yet by playing around with these compounds. And so we're going to miss the day where drugs were organic. And then they did have farmers. They did have farms. They did require a footprint, a target, so to speak. But at least you knew where those things were coming from. And we had decades of experience with these kinds of drugs. Now we're opening up a Pandora's box, I fear, of a brave new world of drugs with all kinds of unknown side effects and consequences.
The UN and the European Union have both been doing a lot better job of tracking these new synthetics, these new psychoactive substances, I should say, entirely, not just synthetics. Obviously, there are a lot of them, but they've been doing a very good job of tracking some of these. And there are hundreds. There are hundreds of these things and more showing up every month.
And they're not using, you know, randomized controls trials. They're, you know, the user is the guinea pig very often. And that's the real danger there.
And what happens when you apply? And what happens when you apply AI to the? That's
Whew. Yeah.
Throw us a ray of sunshine. What can people do about this stuff?
If you go to my Blue Sky account, Sanho at Blue Sky, the pinned tweet is about how to lobby your representatives. It's an old school video from Amnesty International from the '90s, from the mid '90s. But it does give a very good walkthrough of how about the care and feeding of your representatives and how to hold them accountable and how to push them farther and farther. Rather than just taking, oh, thank you for an answer, you could follow up with, you know, and now about the next step and the next step and develop and cultivate a relationship with that member of Congress or their staffer. And people need to do this. We used to teach these kinds of things in civics on how to call your representatives, how to contact them and hold them accountable. And they work for you. But people have been so alienated from their government that we don't really think about these things anymore.
One of the big concerns right now has to do with HIV. PEPFAR is the president's emergency plan for AIDS relief. That's a Bush program from years ago. Funding for that program has been paused. The program itself is on the chopping block. It's worth knowing that that new head of disease and despair, sorry, Health and Human Services, you know, agency names. Right. Anyway, the HHS head, Robbie Kay, is famously an AIDS denier. He doesn't believe in HIV. He thinks AIDS is just a lifestyle thing, you know, poppers and all that. For the younger folks, poppers or amyl nitrites, it's a 20th century thing. You had to be there. Look, the current president has announced his desire to withdraw from the World Health Organization. The United Nations Office on Drugs and Crime, the last time he was in there, we stepped back dramatically. I mean, if it had to do with making money off something like, you know, medicalizing, making pharmaceutical drugs out of marijuana, hey, we're there. But you know, all that other stuff like harm reduction, And could you speak for a moment about this notion of soft power? I mean, we understand the, you know, I mean, military power, force. People sure seem to have an idea of what that is. Soft power actually works.
Yeah. So, you know, this is a rare moment. This is the only time I'll say anything nice about George W. Bush. But PEPFAR was the only good legacy that man left behind. He has saved, that program has saved more than 26 million people in the developing world from HIV and AIDS. And to cut it off at the knees the way they did was brutal. It was sadistic. And it was a giant finger to the world. The Caritas, the Vatican's aid agency, said that millions could die. And this is something that Elon Musk joked about as he was doing this while he was in AID. He said, You know, we just finished throwing AID to the wood chipper. Could have gone to some fancy parties, but did this instead. He was proud of this. And so when the UN Office on AIDS, UN AIDS Agency, says that up to 6 million people could die from AIDS in the next 4 years as a result of killing off PEPFAR, 6 million lives, right? There's an old saying on social media, if you wondered what you would have done in 1930s Germany, you're doing it now, right? And so if there's a chance for you to save 6 million lives by calling your representatives, by protesting, by showing up, and there are no Nazis trying to shoot you for speaking out at this point, you could, you know, put your efforts to saving those 6 million lives. And Elon just laughs about it. It's beyond obscene. This is a Holocaust, and it's happening in slow motion, and it's happening in front of us, and it's done by choice.
I was just reading an article in the Annals of Internal Medicine, published at the time of this record. Well, it was posted on February 11th, and looking at the impact, potential impact of pulling PEPFAR funding from just one country, from the country known colonially as South Africa, from Azania, pulling that funding over 10 years, more than 500,000 new HIV infections.
It's stunning. It's just,
and it's blood on our hands. I mean, you know, it's not our choice, but it's our government, whether we like it, whether we like to think of it that way or not.
And earlier you mentioned they want to destroy Obamacare. They want to destroy all vestiges of public health and privatize everything. And one of the things they've come after is PrEP, right? Which is a pre-exposure prophylactic, basically it's a pill that can basically stop the transmission of HIV in its tracks. And a lot of people take it, especially young people, and they're going to come after that. And right now it's covered. But they want it because it leads to sex that, the right wing doesn't approve of. They want to take that away from you and make you pay for it. It's very expensive.
My guest, you have been listening to Free Culture Radio. I am Doug McVeigh. My guest is Sanho Trees, a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies, where he is the director of their drug policy project. Sanho, tell people again how they can find you on social media, website, all that kind of stuff, and follow the work that you do.
Sure. You can find me at my office, the Institute for Policy Studies, at ips-dc.org. Or catch me on Blue Sky at Sanho at bsky.social on Blue Sky.
There's a my usual question is, what have I not asked you yet that I should have? And one thing that I can think of, actually, that before we end, I've got to ask, what's Colombia? What's happening down there? What's happening with our relations? I know that there was an attempt to put a massive tariff, and then he agreed to do what they were already doing. The president of Colombia agreed to do what they were already doing, and it's sort of like, well, you want me to just say that? Okay. And Trump's like, okay, no tariff. I mean, what? Anyway, what is happening? What's happening there?
President Petro, who I've known for more than 20 years, he is a good guy, but he is also terminally online on Twitter, much like our own head of state. And they got into a match, basically. And Petro did the right thing. He stood up for the dignity of the deportees. The U.S. was putting them on giant Air Force planes, cuffing their hands and chaining their legs and not giving them water, treating them like the Middle Passage, basically, shackled and unfed and no water. And they had to, do 4-hour layovers in Manaus, Brazil, which is in the middle of the Amazon. Incredible heat. People began passing out, right? And so he objected to this. He just, and Colombia has been accepting returnees on civilian flights. They have been for during the Biden presidency. So they're not opposed to accepting their nationals back, but to treat them with a bit of dignity. And that's where Trump threw in the, they got into a match over a trade war and tariffs. So that's not the best outcome. But the thing that really, you asked me what really worries me that you haven't asked about, And that is what Elon is doing with regard to the data in the federal agencies. And so people have talked about him hacking into Treasury and getting after, you know, all kinds of personnel files and Social Security numbers. What really scares me, though, is what's called the SF-86 files. And that's a very DC term. Basically, an SF-86 is the process you go through to get top secret or secret clearance. So anyone with a security clearance, and it happens often to civilian jobs as well, right? You be in a position to see some sensitive data here and there. You have to get a clearance. And the SF-86 clearance process is exhaustive. You have to confess everything that could be possibly used to blackmail you by a foreign adversary. Those files are God-level levels of insight into everyone's vulnerabilities. Any external extramarital affairs you may have had, any visits with prostitutes, any financial crises you've ever experienced, whatever might be make you vulnerable to a foreign intelligence agency is in these files. If Elon has them, and there's some indication that those kids have hacked into these files, he would have unbelievable amounts of blackmail information against every senior person in government or ever was in government. If he has those files, this is how you create an East German Stasi overnight, basically, to have that much dirt on every important person in the government. So I pray he doesn't have those files yet. And we have to do everything in the universe to prevent that from happening, because he will be unstoppable if that happens. He will have dirt on he could blackmail anybody.
The rumor that was how J. Edgar Hoover managed to stay in power for so many decades was having basically had the dirt on everyone.
Exactly. Ooh. Exactly.
Any closing thoughts for our listeners?
Stay strong. It's going to be a long 4 years. We've done this, or at least previous generations have done this. And I take some strength from my late father, who was born in 1927 under the warlords in China. He lived under Japanese occupation in Manchuria, survived World War II, and the Chinese Civil War, fled to Taiwan, where he lived under martial law for 20 years, and then came to this country in the late 60s at the age of 40 and started a brand new life. People are resilient, they can face challenges, and it's important to draw strength from our role models, our ancestors, people who have gone through this before. It won't be easy, but we've persevered before, and I think we can do this again.
That was my conversation with Sanho Tri, a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies, where he's director of IPS's Drug Policy Project. And for now, that's it. Thank you for joining us. You've been listening to Free Culture Radio. I've been your host, Doug McVeigh. A big thank you to Sanho Tri and all the folks at the Institute for Policy Studies. Many thanks to everyone out there fighting for civil rights, human rights, and social justice. And thanks especially to you, dear listener, for your support. You make it all worth it, and you make it all possible. Free Culture Radio is a volunteer production for community radio and syndicated via the Pacifica Foundation Radio Network's AudioPort service. We'll be back in a month to continue our examination of drugs, drug cultures, and the influence of drugs on society. Thanks again for listening. This is Doug McVeigh saying so long. So long. So long.